content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article today is a commentary for a subsection of Religion News Service called The Conversation. The title of this story is The Bible Says Little About Jesus' Childhood. But that didn't stop medieval Christians from enjoying tales of him as holy rascal. This was written by Mary Dizon, Associate Professor of English, University of Tennessee. Manger scenes displayed around Christmas time usually feature an ox and an ass beside the infant Jesus. According to the Gospel of Luke, Mary placed her child in a manger, an animal feeding bin, because there was no room for them in the inn. No mere babysitters, the ox and hearken back to the book of Isaiah 1, verse 3, a verse early Christians interpreted as a prophecy of the birth of Christ. In some early artwork, these beasts of burden kneel to show their reverence, recognizing this swaddled babe who entered the world in humble circumstances as lordly. The canonical Gospels, the accounts of Jesus' life included in the Bible's New Testament, make no mention of those animals welcoming the newborn. Yet the motif was already seen in art from the 4th century. It was further popularized by the Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew, an apocryphal text, that is, one not included in the canon of Scripture. Pseudo-Matthew was composed by an anonymous monk, probably in the 7th century, and includes many tales about Jesus growing up. After its account of Jesus' birth, the Bible is almost entirely silent on his childhood. Yet legends about Jesus' early years circulated widely in the Middle Ages. The focus of my 2017 book. While the detail of the ox and ass is quite familiar to many Christians today, few are aware of the other striking tales transmitted by the Apocrypha. The Bible does include one famous scene from Jesus' youth, the incident when 12-year-old Jesus stayed behind at the Jewish temple in Jerusalem, unbeknownst to his parents. Searching for him with great anxiety, they find him conversing with religious teachers, both asking questions and astounding them with his answers. 14th-century painter Simone Martini's Christ Discovered in the Temple portrays him standing before his parents with crossed arms, a stubborn youth, apparently unapologetic about making them worry for days. The apocryphal Gospel of Pseudo-Matthew, especially versions that incorporate material from an even earlier apocryphal gospel, the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, focuses on the years of Jesus' childhood. Like the temple story, they show the boy Jesus as sometimes difficult and having preternatural wisdom that amazes and even offends his would-be teachers. More dramatically, the apocryphal legends depict Jesus exercising divine power from a very young age. Like the adult Jesus of the New Testament, this apocryphal Christ child often works wonders to help others in need. According to the biblical Gospel of Matthew, Mary and Joseph take the infant Jesus to Egypt after an angel warns in a dream that Herod, the king of Judea, would kill the child. In Pseudo-Matthew's elaboration of this episode, we see Jesus, not yet 2 years old, bravely stand on his feet before dragons emanating from a cave where his family has stopped to rest. The terrifying dragons worship him and then depart, while Jesus boldly assures those around him that he is, quote, the perfect man, end quote, and can tame every kind of wild beast. He later commands a palm tree to bend down so that a weary Mary can partake of its fruits, and he miraculously shortens their journey in the desert. At times, the Jesus of these legends is largely to blame for the troubles around him. The 14th century Tring tiles, now in the British Museum, depict one of Jesus' friends imprisoned by his father in a tower. Christ pulls him out of a tiny hole, like a gallant medieval knight rescuing a maiden in distress. The father had tried to insulate his son from Jesus' influence. Understandable, considering that many legends show Jesus causing the death of his playmates or other boys who somehow irked him. In a story summarized by one scholar as "Death for a Bump," a boy runs into Jesus. He curses the child, who instantly drops down dead, though Jesus brings him back to life after a brief reprimand from Joseph. In another tale included in an Anglo-Norman narrative that survives in an illustrated manuscript, Jesus takes off his coat, places it upon a sunbeam, and sits upon it. When the other children see this, they thought they would do the same, but they were too eager, and they all fell down at once. One and another jumped up quickly onto the sunbeam, but it turned out badly for them, since each one broke his neck. Jesus heals the boys at his parents' prompting. Joseph admits to his neighbors that Jesus was indeed too wild and sends him away. The 7-year-old Jesus becomes apprenticed to a dyer, who gives him very precise directions about dyeing 3 pieces of cloth in 3 different vats. Once his master is left, Jesus ignores his instructions, throwing all the cloth into 1 vat, yet still achieves the desired outcome. When the master returns, he at first thinks he has been ruined by this little rascal, but then realizes that a wonder has occurred. These apocryphal legends also show the boy Jesus having power over the animal world. When he enters a dreaded lion's cave, cubs run about his feet, fawning and playing with him, while the older lions stood at a distance and worshipped him and wagged their tails before him. Jesus tells bystanders that the beasts are better than they are because the animals recognize and glorify their Lord. Indeed, these tales characterize Jesus as a rather haughty boy, conscious of his divinity and not happy with those who treat him as a mere child. At the same time, they depict him as a real child who likes to play. The boy Jesus is childlike in the way he often acts on impulse, not paying much attention to the admonition of his elders. His affinity for animals, too, makes him seem childlike. Strikingly, beasts in the Apocrypha, beginning with the ox and ass, often seem to realize that Jesus is no ordinary child before human characters do. The legend's insidious insinuation that many of the Jews around Jesus were not as perceptive as the animals is part of medieval Europe's widespread anti-Semitism. In one 5th century sermon, Quidvaltius, the bishop of Carthage, asks why the animals' recognition of Jesus in the manger was not a sufficient sign for the Jews. In the Bible, Jesus works his first miracle as an adult at the wedding feast in Cana. The apocryphal tales, however, toy with the idea of the God-man revealing his power early on. The legend suggests that the childishness of Christ distracted many of those around him, preventing them from concluding that he was the Messiah. This allows the Apocrypha to avoid contradicting the Bible's reference to Jesus as simply, quote, the carpenter's son, the opposite of a wonder child. Each Christmas, modern Christians in the Western world would tend to celebrate Jesus' birthday, then quickly drop the theme of the Christ child. Medieval Christians, in contrast, were fascinated by tales about the Son of God growing up. Despite acting as a dragon tamer, physician, and magician, the young Jesus of the Apocrypha largely flies under the radar, cloaking his divinity with little rascal boyishness. Next, when Muslims save lives, the Islamophobia machine looks the other way. This is written by Omar Suleiman for Religion News Service. The truth about a society often reveals itself in moments of crisis, in the unscripted actions of ordinary people. On December 14th in Sydney, when gunmen opened fire on a Hanukkah celebration at Bondi Beach, it was Ahmed Al-Ahmed, a 43-year-old Syrian-born Muslim and Australian immigrant, who ran toward danger. He tackled and disarmed one of the attackers, likely saving countless lives, and was lauded by Australian leaders and global onlookers as a hero. Almost immediately, parts of the far-right internet went to work erasing that reality. Influencers and commentators, fond of Islamophobic narratives, began insisting, without evidence, that Ahmed must be a Christian. Laura Loomer, one of MAGA's boundary guardians, wrote on X, "Credible reports suggest the man is actually a Lebanese or Coptic Christian. Don't fall for the propaganda." These influencers could not tolerate the fact that a Muslim man risked his life to protect Jewish lives. It was too inconvenient for their worldview. On the same day, two students were shot at Brown University. As speculation swirled online, some voices expressed open hope that the shooter would turn out to be Muslim. They needed the tragedy to fit their narrative, proving that he was shouting Allahu Akbar would allow them to spin it their way. Yet Muhammad Aziz Umerzoukov, one of the two students who were killed, was a Muslim himself. This fact received little attention from those who had been so eager to assign blame. This is the dangerous core of Islamophobia today. The prejudice is so entrenched that reality must bend around it. Heroes must be stripped of their Muslim identity. Victims must be reframed as perpetrators. Truth becomes secondary to usefulness. I have experienced this dynamic firsthand. A short, heavily edited clip of me continues to circulate on right-wing accounts designed to misrepresent my stance and inflame anti-Muslim sentiment. This is how manufactured outrage works. A few seconds shown in the clip are divorced from their context, allowing the confected narrative to take hold. This is not accidental. Islamophobia is a political industry that depends on constant fear, distortion, and dehumanization. Nor is it only a domestic political weapon, but a global information strategy. In the United Kingdom, Tommy Robinson, founder of the English Defense League, continues to build a movement around portraying Muslims as incompatible with Western society, using exaggeration, fabrication, and selective storytelling. Multiple investigations and analyses show how anti-Muslim sentiment is deliberately amplified to distract from mass violence and suppress criticism. One expose found that the Israeli Ministry of Diaspora Affairs funded online influence campaigns that pushed pro-Israel messaging alongside anti-Muslim content. The goal was to shape public opinion by portraying Muslims as inherently threatening, making it easier to deflect attention from atrocities in Gaza. Scholars analyzing the rhetoric around Gaza argue that Islamophobia is central to rhetoric attempting to justify or minimize Palestinian suffering by reframing the structural realities of occupation and mass death as natural responses to an inherently barbaric people. Civil rights advocates have warned that some pro-Israel political actors are using Islamophobia to discredit critics, distract from documented war crimes, and frame solidarity with Palestinians as extremism. Western media outlets, in addition, often rely on Islamophobic framing when covering Gaza, sidelining Palestinian voices while centering narratives that serve power rather than truth, according to reporting by the Bridge Initiative at Georgetown University. These studies show that Islamophobia is not a byproduct of confusion or lack of education about Islam, it is driven and amplified by a recognizable cast of figures and platforms. Far-right provocateurs such as Loomer make conspiratorial claims about Muslims, painting an entire faith community as a national security threat and pushing false narratives to millions of followers. These figures cultivate an audience conditioned to believe Muslims are uniquely violent or suspect. So when someone like Ahmed al-Ahmad acts like a hero in Sydney, the system malfunctions. The narrative must be rewritten. Once a community is dehumanized digitally, it becomes easier to continue to marginalize, exclude, or harm that community physically. But the truth must break through. Ahmed al-Ahmad did not stop to ask the religion of the people he shielded. He acted on faith, courage, and conscience. He has been rightfully recognized widely for the hero he is, despite constant attempts to vilify his community. This is the crisis of our moment. When a Muslim is a victim, their humanity is erased. When a Muslim is a hero, their identity is erased. Islamophobia thrives on erasure. It thrives on fear. It thrives on distortion and distraction. But narratives built on fear are brittle when confronted with truth. Muslims today are part of the social fabric of every place they call home. They are students, caregivers, neighbors, and yes, heroes. Their courage and compassion defy bigotry's attempt to confine them to caricature. If we want a society worth living in, then truth must matter more than fear. Heroism must matter more than narrative convenience. And human dignity must matter more than political utility. The Islamophobia machine is in full swing, but the truth keeps clogging its system. Our third story. With mantras and a tricycle, Buddhist nun supports Denver's unhoused. This was written by Fiona Murphy for the Religion News Service. On a cool morning in Denver, a 70-year-old Buddhist nun pedaled their electric tricycle beneath highway overpasses and along cracked bike paths, slowing as they approached tents tucked against concrete embankments or someone sleeping under a bridge. The small trailer fastened to the trike carried bottled water, bagged lunches, socks, gloves, Narcan, tents, and hand warmers. The cyclist, Kelsang Vera, who uses they-them pronouns, has become a familiar presence to many people living on Denver's streets over the past 5 years. The nun, who helped found Mutual Aid Monday, which now feeds more than 400 vulnerable and unhoused people a week, scans the grittiest parts of the city for familiar faces. "I think I know most people here," Vera said after handing out supplies at a homeless encampment on the outskirts of Lakewood, where about 30 people who were gathered around tents and wearing winter jackets approached them for water and food, saying ma'am and thanking the nun profusely. Just before Vera arrived at the camp, the nun had stopped under a bridge to check on a man who appeared to have passed out, likely after using fentanyl, an extremely powerful opioid that has become Colorado's leading cause of drug-related deaths in the past 5 years. "He wouldn't show me his face," Vera said. "When I saw him under the bridge, it's like whatever pops into my head is the mantra that's needed." As Vera engages in what they call street outreach, the work of Mutual Aid Monday, or MAM, they feel most drawn to the nun keeps a rotation of Tibetan Buddhist mantras, running quietly in their mind. Emerging from a dark shade of an overpass, Virya will often whisper their primary mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, associated with the Buddha of compassion and believed to relieve suffering. Virya turns to it instinctively whenever they encounter someone in distress. Virya grew up Lutheran in Wisconsin, but as an adult, while raising children and working in hospice care, they began reading Thich Nhat Hanh and Pema Chodron before eventually finding their way to Tibetan Buddhism. "What really drew me to Buddhism was the compassion," they said. Virya was ordained more than 15 years ago and follows a tradition in which daily vows, prayers, and study shape monastic life. "I retake my vows every day," they said. "I haven't missed in 15 and a half years." After checking that the man under the bridge did not need Narcan, Virya murmured the Om Tara Tutare Ture Sura mantra under their breath, saying it was the one that surfaced first because Tara is the rescue Buddha. "I would be so depressed," Virya said. "I could not do this work. I have to have my faith that grounds me every day and is a refuge." This work began for Virya in 2019 when they and their granddaughter started taking bagged lunches to large encampments across Denver. They had moved to the city 12 years earlier to be closer to their son, having spent 3 previous years living at a monastery in New Mexico. In 2020, amid the pandemic, and as homelessness surged in the city, the nun began showing up at encampment sweeps several times a week to protest, as police were often reportedly poking holes in people's tents, damaging personal property, and handing out tickets. Denver has long enforced an unauthorized camping ordinance, commonly known as the Urban Camping Ban, which prohibits sleeping in public spaces and has shaped how homelessness is managed in the city for more than a decade. The policy has made encampment sweeps a regular feature of life for people living on the streets, often forcing them to move with little notice and limited access to shelter. But after an unhoused person told Virya the police came down harder after protesters left, Virya changed tactics. The next day, the nun showed up with coffee and donuts in a small red wagon instead. "Just be there for them and listen to them," they said. As they spent more time at camps, Virya began to recognize another gap. Unhoused people were losing not only their belongings during sweeps, but also any opportunity to tell city leaders what was happening to them. So Virya and a small group of activists brought their idea to the steps of the city and county building. Monday nights at City Hall, when public comment is held, has historically drawn unhoused residents and advocates seeking to be heard. And when it was there, the group established Mutual Aid Mondays. "We decided that maybe we'd have a place where they could come and get food and gear, and the other half was to try to encourage folks to go to city council," Virya said. "That's why it's on Monday, so they could let them know what's going on our streets." The idea was simple: offer food, gear, and a safe place to gather so people could step out of the encampments, get what they needed, and, if they chose, go inside and speak during public comment. Virya cooked up a lot of food and was in their kitchen on Sunday all day preparing for Monday, said Jess Wiederholt, a Denver activist, mother of 7, practicing Presbyterian, and one of the founders of MAM. "And then the rest of us all brought something, you know, like I was the pasta person." What began with about 50 people and a handful of volunteers serving food has expanded into a weekly scene outside City Hall that unfolds into a temporary village where up to 50 volunteers unload tents, sleeping bags, and hygiene kits, lay out Narcan supplies on folding tables, and even set up a barber's chair. In the early days, Virya cooked with whatever they could source from local food banks, mostly oatmeal and fish casserole. Today, the organization relies largely on donations through platforms such as Patreon, and Virya recently received a $2,000 transportation grant from the city that paid for her electric tricycle. Haircuts come almost every week, Virya said. It just gives people so much self-esteem, you know, to get their hair done. Virya has also come to be known for driving a white van across Denver on the coldest winter nights, circling encampments with blankets, heaters, and food, calling out for anyone who might need a ride to a hotel room where they could safely spend the night. Many unhoused Denverites still recall those late-night searches as the difference between danger and survival. During cold nights for 24 hours straight, Virya would be going to every nook and cranny in Denver to find people, said Raymond, who has been unhoused in Denver for 6 years. When it was life and death, she was there. In 2025, about 10,774 people in the Denver metro area were experiencing homelessness, including those staying in shelters and transitional housing. A 2025 Metro Denver Homeless Initiative study puts the average number of people on the streets any given night at between 785 to 2,149 in the large Denver metro area. Jerry Burton, a Marine veteran and former unhoused activist who now works with the House Keys Action Network, has been involved with Mutual Aid Monday since its earliest days. Now he moves through the weekly gathering, passing out flyers about low-income housing resources. Something has to drive you to do this work, Wiederholt said. And for Virya and me, it was our faith. No matter what the faith is, we believe in the dignity of human beings. That's a big part of who we are and what we believe. And so we were out here because of that. In the past year, Virya has begun to step away from MAM's expanding daily operations, hoping to return to the rhythm of monastic life that first grounded her work. Each day, Virya recites vows, prays, meditates, and studies Buddhist texts. Still, they spend several days a week visiting encampments on her tricycle, offering supplies, conversation, and whispering ancient mantras under their breath. They say that connecting one-on-one with people on the street can feel a bit like spreading the calming practice of meditation. They're getting a little peace of mind for at least a few minutes, Virya said, and maybe they will return to that, despite everything, again and again. That last story was edited a bit because we've run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.